Hi, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology. I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte in New York. And today I'm speaking to Margot Esther Borden. She is a psychotherapist, international public speaker, and adjunct professor at Antioch University Midwest. She completed her training in breathwork in Paris and her Master of Arts in person-centered counseling / humanistic psychology at the University of Durham. She works in India, Europe, and the United States, and is co-editor of Spirituality and Business, Exploring Possibilities for a New Management Paradigm. And the book we're discussing today is entitled Psychology in the Light of the East, published by Roman and Littlefield in 2017. Margot, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Eugenia.
So Margot, first off, can you tell us where you're talking to us from?
Sure. I'm in Ranchi, India, it's a small town. It's a tier three city, and it's the place where Paramahansa Yogananda has an ashram. He started a school here many years ago, it's a tier three city, so sometimes the internet might be a little patchy. So far, so good, though. So let's keep our hopes up, huh?
So I'll ask my listeners to bear with us as we try to speak across the planet, really.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. What is your background in terms of your training and your experience?
So I think I'd like to just start with, you know, growing up in the United States, in the end of the hippie era, and in a place that was very materialistic, and all of these messages were coming to me about what life was supposed to be. And it was, you know, going to be a bigger house and a bigger car, and it was the whole material paradigm. And it led me to start my quest, which was questioning, what am I doing here? What is the meaning of life? And where am I going with this? In addition to that, having been born an empath, which means someone who can basically put themselves in someone else's shoes and feel what they're feeling in a very pronounced and detailed way, led me to, you know, question what is the meaning of life? Who are we? So that led to my decision to become a psychotherapist from a very young age. I knew that I wanted to help people. So I started out more on the spiritual, track. My first training was in breath work, which is basically a means of breathing and aligning ourselves to the life force, which is breath, and bringing out and clearing anything that is disharmonious in our being. So it's a very, very psycho-spiritual approach. It's therapeutic, but it's also, it cannot be, it's not, you know, psychoanalysis or behaviorism. It's very, very psycho-spiritual, meaning that the vision of it or the understanding of it is that through the breath, we walk into our blockages and our barriers and our disharmonies and keep going in to finally alignment with our own soul, which is the core of our being. So that was like my beginning as a therapist.
But does that mean that from the very beginning, once you decided you wanted to be a therapist, that you instantly were drawn more towards Eastern philosophy or ways of practicing and not so much drawn to Western psychology?
I knew I wanted to be a therapist when I was really, I think I first remember saying that when I was 12 years old. So I didn't really have a knowledge of any schools of psychology, but I was already practicing yoga by then. So I had found an amazing yoga teacher and was already sort of, you know, tuning into a different paradigm than you know, typical Western upbringing. But then in California, you know, I guess, what do you want, huh? So, and I think in those days, yoga was, you know, more spiritually oriented and less physical than it tends to be today. So it was just a very simple, very pure approach. So yeah. So then when I started to go into the helping professions, it was based on a spontaneous meeting with somebody while I was hitchhiking around Ireland. And I, you know, made it to, through the grapevine, went to someone's house, and they started to explain how they use the breath to help people heal. And I probably looked like, you know, I didn't understand what they were talking about. And she said, well, I guess the only way for you to understand is to try it. So I did my first breathwork technique when I was 22, a session. And I was the client, and it was earth shattering. I went in the space of 2 hours. I began to discover my emotions and the emotions that we suppress and that we dissociate from, and all of the different things that we do with our emotions apart from consciously living them. And as each wave of emotion, maybe there was sadness and grief and, you know, anger and frustration and all the sort of normal things that we grow up with but don't necessarily know how to pay attention to. And as the time went on, I began to discover a sense of expansiveness within me and a sense of sort of a force of love and truth that was coming from within, and that felt, you know, basically made everything else fade away, you know. And it felt universal, and it felt a sense of connection with all that is, you know. It was a fabulous experience, and that changed my life.
Wow. You also have training in humanistic and Rogerian psychology, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so what happens is after that session, I went and trained in breath work. And it was wonderful. You spend a year of your life totally dedicated to pulling out all the stops within and, you know, getting in touch with and harmonizing all of the inner parts of yourself. It's an inner journey. And the goal is that to become comfortable and to make space for everything that's inside of us, so that when our clients bring up their issues, we feel comfortable and we have space for them, fully give them space to be in their experience. So that was a very kind of, it was really nice. And as you can hear, philosophically, I'm sure you're resonating with that, but it was also very limited because I didn't have a degree in psychology. And so I found myself working with more marginal types of people and not having access to mainstream people who could get a lot of benefit from, you know, from therapy. So I went and signed up to do my master's degree in humanistic psychology. Decided, you know, got to have a degree.
Mm-hmm. And how did that complement your training? And how was it different? How was Rogerian psychology different from, or even complementary to, what you had learned up to that point?
So I think the approach that I had trained in was very explicitly spiritual, and didn't necessarily have a very sophisticated psychological dimension, apart from like maybe healing the emotions or something. And so I'm embarrassed as I say this, although it was many, many years ago. I was probably a bit of a bulldozer therapist. You know, it's like, you got to get in there and take out all the stuff and heal. And so, you know, as we know, the key principles of humanistic psychology are, you know, unconditional positive regard, warmth, non-judgment, And so I learned how to hold a space for people and walk with them in their world, in their time, in their language, and not bulldoze them. So this is a little bit my self-deprecating humor. So you can just...
Well, for people who are not familiar, what is it about, what are some of the key principles of Rogerian psychology?
It's really, Carl Rogers was an amazing, amazing human being. And I highly recommend his book on being a person. And he also wrote a book on education, which is, you know, phenomenal. And it's so that it's just the principle of really walking alongside the person and holding a space for what's there, rather than having an agenda. I got to get somewhere and I got to find out what's it. So we're not into diagnosis. We're into accompaniment. And we're also, humanistic psychology was one of the first schools, in the modern era to focus on human potential rather than human pathology and abnormality.
So then what is the goal of humanistic or Rogerian psychology?
Okay, so the goal would be something like if I sit with you and have an open, warm, non-judgmental, open space, that I hold that space for you and that we hold that space together as you walk into your less comfortable aspects and the shadow and all this kind of thing, that you start to take on the parts that we normally try to escape from, like by resisting, and we start to reclaim and bring light to all the parts of our being, rather than just the parts that we accept and that are easy to deal with. So it's self. I think it leads to self-acceptance and just opening, you know, opening to ourselves, self-discovery.
I want to talk about the book now, because that's number one why you're here, but also because it's so comprehensive, and you really seem to be achieving quite a lot in the book. First of all, what was your aim in writing this book?
I didn't have an aim. I just actually what happened is I just started having ideas come forth. And of course, those ideas were triggered from years of accompanying people, years of working on myself, and years of reading, you know, reading everything in the fields of humanistic and transpersonal psychology, and also yoga philosophy, yoga psychology, sort of Eastern and Western things. And all of a sudden, it's almost like it all just started to come together. And all these ideas were flooding out, and they came so fast and furious that I started recording them, and that lasted about 2 months. And they would my thoughts would come day and night, and whenever they would come, and I would just record them because it was, you know, I didn't want to turn the light on and start writing in the middle of the night. And after about 2 months, the flow of thoughts stopped. And it's like I had reached the end. I had said what I needed to say. And I took the recordings and transcribed them and found myself sitting with 300 pages of notes. And a little voice in my head, somewhere in my being, said, "You have to turn this into a book." So.
And the book is entitled Psychology in the Light of the East, which kind of tips us off to what it's about. But could you tell us more explicitly what this book ended up being about?
Yeah. So basically it I think that I did have some things to say to address your earlier question about the state of Western psychology and how it very efficiently addresses certain aspects of ourselves, but by nature of trying to fit into a scientific paradigm and, you know, just by being more pragmatic, sort of doesn't address, for me, what is the essence of who we are, which is the soul. And so I had stuff to say about, like, we need to open up the scope and reclaim our right to be fully human, body, mind, soul, and spirit. not just behavior and or emotions or thoughts. So the book starts out with a timeline. 10,000 years ago, actually 30,000 years ago, was the first spiritual symbol found in India at the Bhimbetka rock structures in Madhya Pradesh. And then the timeline goes, there's an east and west column, and it goes from there all the way to date. And what we find is that 10,000 years ago, which is when it, the big picture starts in the book, the world by and large had a shamanistic worldview. You know, nature spirits and people, healers having access to the subtle world, and there were people using breath or using shamanistic approaches to heal individuals who had disturbance. And our psycho-spiritual beliefs and healing modalities were holistic. They took into consideration the whole self. And what happened is, little by little in the West, and there are various phases, and I talk about them in my book, where we descend down from that holistic worldview and start to become more outward-looking, tending to want to be more scientific. So philosophy in and of itself started out with Socrates. You know, let's say if we look at Socrates, it didn't start with Socrates, which was, he had, his definition of the psyche was soul. And then we come down to Aristotle, whose definition of the psyche was mind. Okay, so that's one area. And there are other, like, periods in time where we see ourselves really just taking a step into a different paradigm, away from the holistic worldview. And so little by little, then we came into the scientific worldview and our view of mental health, which is neurobiological and cognitive behavioral by and large. So, which are mechanistic and reductionistic. And my question and my challenge in that worldview is, where is the soul? Where's our right to a soul and our spiritual experiences and our potential for transcendence and for greater a greater potential?
I want to highlight that aspect of your book, because anybody who appreciates or enjoys reading about history is going to appreciate what you've done, which is to really sketch out the history of the relationship between psychology and spirituality. And I want to go back to the part of your book where you write about Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, because if I'm reading you correctly, you're saying that Aristotle, who is considered the father of psychology, that with Aristotle there was a slight shift away from spirituality, which we had seen with Socrates?
Yes, yeah, yeah. And in the book, I actually tell the story of, you know, this question that was pressing in my mind since always. Why in the West do we see God as outside of ourselves rather than the Eastern view of, you know, an indwelling divine? And when did the split occur? And then on a sort of an aside, and what are the implications of that split? You know, how am I going to conduct my life and make my decisions and motivate myself differently if I see God as an outer, in some cases punitive or judgmental being, or an inner light to which I can rise up and align myself. And so we see in the book, in my story, how I discovered, you know, that one of the splits occurred then between Socrates and Aristotle, and the sages of the day admitted to themselves they no longer understood the mysteries and began to look outward and quantify and analyze and categorize, rather than, you know, a kind of a multidimensional or a subtle perception of the truth. It fell into the mind.
And why do you think that happened? Why do you think Western psychology amputated spirituality from its body of knowledge and practice?
I often ponder that question, and we could, you know, I think I'd like to just say it's a mystery, and it's a mystery that I struggle with, but that I also want to honor as a part of a process. Just as a child has to go through, a kind of a shadow period, you know, maybe like heavy metal or goth style, and or sometimes in the West, young people, it's like a rite of passage going through drugs or going through a dark phase and then coming home, you know, re-emerging out of that and coming home to themselves. And that's what I'm imagining, and that's what I'm seeing already in the West, that we sort of really split off. And then with the movements of humanistic psychology, which reclaim the right to have a potential and to be fully human, and then the emergence in the, let's say, 50s, 60s, starting with Jung, of transpersonal psychology, reclaiming the right to a spiritual dimension. So in a sense, we're re-expanding out, although the mainstream paradigm is still scientific and reductionistic.
You talk in the book about transpersonal psychology, and I want you to tell us what is transpersonal psychology?
Transpersonal psychology is emerged out of the fact that the schools of psychology at the time, up until the 50s, didn't have a spiritual dimension. And yet, you know, a large percentage of people in the world have spiritual experiences, peak experiences, deep insights, transformations, premonitions. And so transpersonal psychology developed out of a desire to address that aspect of, you know, conversion experiences, shamanic awakenings, these kinds of things, and recognize that as a normal and natural part of human potential that can be addressed. And in addressing it, we eliminate the risk of pathologizing spiritual experience, which we could say Freud by and large did, turning it into an opportunity for transformation, for healing, for wholeness, and for, you know, being a useful part of our lives, rather than being, you know, someone who's had a spiritual experience being labeled and stigmatized, can become, you know, a fully functioning human being with a spiritual dimension.
Mm-hmm. And in talking about transpersonal psychology, you introduce us to the concept of spiritual emergencies. Yes. Which I thought was really interesting. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. So Stanislav Grof, I think, was the person who discovered that sometimes what looks like psychosis might actually be a form of spiritual awakening that is chaotic. And so it looks, it can have psychotic features. And these types of experiences can occur on meditation retreats or personal development seminars, or during childbirth, even running a marathon. At any time that the mind becomes single-mindedly focused, we can enter into transcendence, and we may not have the personality structure, the level of cohesiveness in our being to be able to handle what emerges. And so that's called a spiritual emergency, and it's a really fabulous thing to take into consideration. So that rather than, as I was saying earlier, pathologizing and labeling and medicating people, when we can determine that in fact it's, you know, a chaotic spiritual experience and not psychosis, and help the person to integrate and to you know, walk them through this experience in their own time and in their own way, and turn it into an opportunity. You
know, an opportunity. But when you're working with someone who's displaying this sort of experience, how do you talk to the client in order to ascertain or figure out if in fact this is a spiritual emergency, and what the specific nature of the spiritual emergency is?
Okay, so there are healthy and pathological manifestations of spirituality, as I'm sure any helping professional has seen. Generally, it's you know, there's many criteria, and there are books written on the subject. But if the person has a history of mental illness, you know, we're going to tend more towards psychosis. And if it, for example, but some of the people who I've dealt with who are in spiritual emergency have had perfectly normal lives and go to an ashram somewhere, or you know, go on a Vipassana retreat and flip out. And so what we're looking at then is not only talking in terms of perhaps helping them to understand their experience and to know that it's they're not ill and they're going to be okay, but also of maybe using other techniques like mindfulness or breath or other healing techniques. In my book, I talk about Jinshin Jitsu, which is a Japanese energetic balancing technique. So using a psycho-spiritual model to help the person integrate that experience. And it can take, you know, several, around a normal spiritual emergency naturally lasts about 3 months is what's the latest research is.
So as a therapist, one needs to not flip out oneself, and one needs to really kind of reframe one's approach in order to work in this way. If what you're seeing is something that would normally call for a diagnosis and medication, that your approach really requires that one be patient and one look at it quite differently.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we need to look at parameters about is the patient in danger or this kind of thing. But a DSM diagnosis is gonna miss out on the subtleties and the potentials and just put a label there. And so it may be, you know, we obviously need to take it into consideration and watch. But for me, I've been working with spiritual experiences and spiritual emergency for so long that it is fairly obvious to the distinction. And so, yeah, it's about accompanying, and, you know, it might be putting together a team of people, you know, someone to do energy work and someone to talk and someone to do other, you know, sort of a holistic approach to walking the person back. And the person is going to be, you know, having intense experiences and needing to purge maybe undigested emotions or, you know, maybe in some state of confusion and definitely fear. But it's definitely not psychosis.
Well, you know, in describing the phenomenon of spiritual experiences, spiritual emergencies, you used a word that I want to go back to. You used the word chaos. And in your book, you talk about the influence that Hinduism and yogic philosophy and even India had on the therapist that you've become. And I remember in the book, you use the word chaos to describe what it's like in India and your relationship to that chaos. And I want you to tell us about that and how India and yogic philosophy and Hinduism have shaped you, but also what role chaos has had in that.
Okay. Just as we started out at the beginning, looking at the timeline and how in the West we split off from the psycho-spiritual worldview and descended gradually into a scientific worldview, in the East, it didn't split off. And so there is still to this day one cohesive worldview that's been going for thousands and thousands of years. So the center is a mystical worldview, and it's not theoretical. It's almost like it's inherent in people's system here in India, where I spend a lot of time and work. And around that mystical core is included, let's say, philosophy, medicine, science, psychology, religion, but the core is mystical. And that's what brought me to India, is a craving for something that would, for one cohesive worldview that took into consideration all of who we are, from the mundane aspects and the material drives and our emotions and our intellects, but also our transcendent nature and our potential for spiritual realization or enlightenment. So that's what brought me to India, and yeah, the chaos. It's really fun. You have two choices in the face of chaos. And in the West, where our infrastructure is so well built and our mindsets are much structured differently, and we're not used to chaos. And so when chaos happens, we might resist it or get grumpy, where in India there's just a flow that's in and beyond the entire experience of India, and many Indians and Westerners that I've spoken to have agreed that you have to surrender. We can't pretend to be in control and to and to, you know, like that everything happens in an orderly fashion, even such things as the internet. And so we surrender, and you go with you either let go and go with the flow, or you suffer.
And have you integrated that into how you work and how you think as a therapist?
Yes. Yeah. My sense of, and I don't think I've ever spoken to anybody about this, of a sort of a wholesome psyche is one that is fluid. Okay. And part of the work that we do as therapists is to find the kinks, the resistances, the blockages, the things that aren't in the flow in our being, old emotions, thoughts, beliefs, misunderstandings, all kinds of things like that, and examine them and give them some space and breathe into them and make them more, you know, bring them into the flow so that our entire being is aligned and there's nothing sort of, there's no stuck places or kinks. And so that would go with, you know, the core essence of the Indian experience is, you know, just you have to the surrender.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And obviously, when you talk about flow, for me at least, and I'm sure for many listeners, that brings to mind yogic philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, I got to say, as a novice yogi myself, I have become a little bit acquainted with what you refer to as the essence of Indian psychology, and that's the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. But for listeners who are unfamiliar, what are the Yoga Sutras?
Basically, I think it's the oldest text on yoga, and it's quite detailed. I talk about it in my book if you want to have a very nice and short overview of the principles, but it's basically, yoga has many meanings, and it can be anything from asanas or exercise, as we, you know, as sometimes we do in the West, all the way to the most noble meaning, the core meaning of the word yoga, which is alignment with the inner divine. And so yoga is one is the physical the physical yoga is basically preparing us and preparing the body and preparing the mind and getting us into the flow and cleaning out some of the the stuck places and opening us to the inner flow. And then there's just we could talk for hours on the Yoga Sutras, so I probably can't go into detail. Yeah, but.
But do you think that they're in conversation or can be in conversation with Western psychology?
I definitely think so. I've spent my last year since the book came out going to conferences, and in July I was at the World Congress of Psychology in Paris, and I just assumed I would meet a bunch of colleagues who have the cognitive behavioral and analytical views, and in fact the spiritually oriented talks were full, is standing room only, and as was my talk. And I was pleasantly surprised to see that a lot of helping professionals are exploring that paradigm, and then you have a lot that are in total resistance and denial and at war, willing to, to block what the transpersonal movement is trying to do and the integral movement. So you'll just find the full spectrum. But there's a lot of openness and a lot of discovery already happening.
And so what is integral psychology? Because you introduce us to that as well in the book. And how's it different from transpersonal?
Yeah. So transpersonal psychology is, by and large, the study of spiritual experiences and our spiritual dimensions and potential. Integral psychology, so there's two schools of integral psychology. One is in the West, and it's sort of the person who brought that into being and wrote books about it is Ken Wilber, although there's a lot of other people writing and practicing today. He was the founder of it. And it's a very beautiful, comprehensive model. It's very intellectually intricate, and it looks at the whole of human experience. And it looks at all of the great, the large movements of East and West from past and present, and puts them all into perspective in terms of levels of consciousness and human potential. It's very, very elaborate. So that was my early discovery of integral psychology. And then but being myself, someone who, a yogi, I could say, my drive was to find a school that was mystically based. And so when I discovered the work of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, who are two saints, from India who were based in Pondicherry, that was when I found, I had found my psycho-spiritual home, if you will. So again, we're looking at a comprehensive worldview, leaving room for East, West, past, present, and future. But the core of Sri Aurobindo's work is mystical, and the essence of it is that the core of my being is the soul, and beyond the soul is the spirit, or the one, the highest divine force that exists, and that all life is a journey home to our true inner self. And I think we can find that in a lot of I've seen that, I've read texts that tell us the same thing in Judaism and Christianity with the Christian mystics. So it's not unique. But there are some attributes to Sri Aurobindo's work that are unique too, but it's pretty detailed. So, it's the sense of it's almost like a spiritual roadmap and a human roadmap of what are all the forces within me, how can I get to know them and understand them and distinguish the voices of the outer self, the ego, which is comprised of the body, the mind, and the emotions, and this, find that subtle inner voice, that voice that is increasingly subtle and increasingly universal, the voice of the soul or the inner divine.
And the idea, I suppose, is that making that connection can be healing.
Yes, it's a healing journey. Yeah.
So, you know, one of the last chapters in your book is entitled The Making of an Integral Psychotherapist, which I think is really useful because there might be a lot of people out there who've studied only Western psychology, but they're interested in what they're hearing in this interview, and they're wondering how they can go about becoming more integral themselves. What should such people do?
So basically, I mean, for me, there's what we do. For example, I'm a psychoanalyst, I'm Jungian, I'm Freudian, I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist. And then there's the consciousness with which we do it. Okay, and the consciousness is going to have, Sri Aurobindo says, is more important even than let's say our school of thought. And so it's basically essentially to, I think as therapists we're sensitive beings and we're curious beings and we question. So why not open that up to our spiritual dimensions and our greater potential? And so we talk about the various ways of psycho-spiritual healing and spiritual development, like meditation and things like that. And so I do, yeah, I go into my elaborate theory on, how can, someone develop their own consciousness to be able to work in a way with their clients that is multidimensional, not just theoretically saying, okay, we're multidimensional beings, but actually opening up their own connection and subtle perception.
You know, Margo, we're almost out of time, but this book has been such a journey, and of course, talking to you about it has been such a journey. And before we finish our journey, I want to ask you what you're working on next and what people can look forward to from you.
Well, right now I am working on a screenplay, and it's a funny story of my experiences in India and over the many, many years I've accumulated, and I'm compiling them all into something that I hope will be very funny. And but also empowering and insightful, uplifting. So that's going to take another year or two, because from what I understand, to turn the story into the screenplay and then the screenplay into a movie, if it all comes to pass the way I'd like it to. Yeah, and then I have notes for another book which cover the same ideas, but hopefully will be more general public. So I had set out to write a book for the general public, and it turned out to be more like a text, a light text and light academic book, the Psychology in the Light of the East. So
we will definitely look forward to both of those. Do you know who you want to play you in your movie?
Yeah, there's a, it's going to be produced in India, and there's a an Indian actress who's half French, and I think she would be fabulous, but that's, we're all in out on a limb in speculation mode here, so it's.
Well, those both sound really exciting. I hope you'll let us know when the next book is out, and that you'll come back and talk to us about it.
Oh, thank you so much. I really found this delightful, and your questions were amazing and open-minded and deep, and I really appreciate your presence.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate you, and we appreciate you coming on and talking to us.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay, take care. Thank you.